If you stand in front of Vincent van Gogh's bedroom in Arles today, you are basically being lied to by chemistry.
Oh, absolutely. It's a total deception.
Right. Because that calming, iconic blue wall that millions of people travel across the globe to see, it is a total accident.
Yeah, if you really look at the history of this painting, that pristine, quiet feeling you get, you know, when staring at it in a climate-controlled museum, it just completely shatters.
It really does. So, welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, our mission is to take you on a journey into the hidden history behind one of the most famous, seemingly tranquil spaces in all of art history.
We're unpacking Van Gogh's bedroom in Arles.
Exactly. And to get to the bottom of this, we are pulling from a really fascinating stack of sources today.
A really great stack.
Yeah, we have a dense, highly technical comparative study from Cornell University, plus some historical archives focused on Van Gogh's infamous Yellow House.
We're also looking at Wikipedia entries tracking the three distinct versions of the painting, which includes a massive pop art parody, actually.
Right, and maybe most importantly, we are diving into Vincent van Gogh's actual handwritten letters.
It is a phenomenal collection of evidence because we are bridging the gap between, you know, high-performance laboratory science and the deeply personal correspondence of a man who was really on the brink.
Because the story these sources tell is just staggering. We are going to show you how the physical colors on the canvas have literally evaporated over time.
Which is wild to think about.
And we are going to reveal how this priceless masterpiece was once held together by, wait for it, wet, sticky newspaper.
Oh, that detail is incredible.
I know, right? And we're going to explore why it even exists in three completely different versions. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Well, to really understand what is happening inside that bedroom, you first have to step outside of it.
Okay, take us there.
You have to imagine standing in the glaring, relentless light of Arles, down in the south of France. This is 1888.
So he moved there to escape Paris, right?
Exactly. He moved there to get away from the city, and he rented four rooms in a building at 2 Place Lamartine.
Which is the famous Yellow House.
Yes, the Yellow House. Mm. He actually painted the exterior of this building in a piece he initially called The Street.
Right.
And his goal with all of this was to conquer what he called the, and this is a quote, sulfur sun under a pure cobalt sky.
Wow, sulfur sun. That sounds intense.
It was. The light in Arles wasn't just bright, it was aggressive. So he was using the two large rooms on the ground floor as his studio and his kitchen.
Got it.
And then on the first floor, he had two smaller rooms.
Oh.
One was a guest room he was feverishly trying to prepare for the arrival of Paul Gauguin.
His friend and fellow artist.
Right. And the other room was his own personal bedroom.
Which is where things get physically strange, because I caught this detail in the historical archives and I couldn't stop thinking about it.
The shape of the room.
Yes. If you were trying to design a relaxing space, you know, for sleep, you wouldn't choose this room. It was shaped like a crooked trapezoid.
It's so bizarre.
It really is. The front wall facing the street had an obtuse angle on the left side and this really sharp, acute angle on the right.
So it wasn't a perfect rectangle at all.
Not even close.
And just standing in a room with skewed geometry naturally creates a sort of subtle psychological unease, you know? It messes with your spatial perception.
Right. But Van Gogh's intention for this room and for the painting he made of it was the exact opposite of unease. He was trying to construct a feeling of absolute peace.
Which he practically spells out for us in the sources.
He does. In a letter to Gauguin, I think it's letter B22, Vincent describes the first version of the painting. He literally writes that looking at the picture ought to, quote, rest the mind, or rather, the imagination.
It's almost like he is obsessively curating the perfect Airbnb for his friend.
Yes, that is exactly what it feels like. But instead of like buying a nice scented candle and some throw pillows, he is deploying rigorous color theory and thick oil paint to force a psychological state of calm onto anyone who steps into the room.
Or anyone who looks at the canvas. What's fascinating here is the stark contrast between Van Gogh's chaotic, exhausted mental state at the time and his highly calculated approach to this painting.
Because we have this cultural image of him as a purely impulsive, you know, messy artist.
Exactly, the mad genius trope. But in reality, he had just been bedridden for days with an illness. He was physically shattered. Yet he approaches this canvas with meticulous precision.
He's very intentional.
Extremely. He writes about using what he calls flat tints, which were inspired by Japanese prints, and he applied them with a really thick, heavy impasto.
And he completely eliminates the shadows, right?
Yes. There are no cast shadows in the painting at all, which flattens everything out and sort of removes the harshness of that aural sun I mentioned earlier.
So to get that absolute restfulness, he relies on a highly specific palette of complementary colors. And he lists this recipe out perfectly in his letters.
He really does.
He describes pale lilac walls, a faded red floor, chrome yellow furniture, pale green citron sheets, and a blood red blanket.
And don't forget the orange washstand, the blue wash basin, and the green windows.
Right. When you read that list, it's this incredibly vibrant, vibrating color palette, where the opposites, like the red of the floor and the green of the windows, they balance each other out to create harmony.
But here is the massive contradiction that puzzled art historians for decades.
The big reveal.
Yeah, because if you walk into the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam today and look at the first version of this painting, the walls are not pale lilac.
Nope, they are a light blue.
And the floor is not faded red. It looks like this muddy grayish blue or sort of greenish brown.
It completely changes the mood.
It does. The careful complementary balance he so obsessively engineered is completely gone.
Which means the painting we revere in the museum is physically not the painting he described creating. So, and this is where I need you to explain the science to me. How does a painting just lose its colors?
This is where that Cornell University technical study comes in. And the science here is just thrilling.
Thrilling for a chemistry nerd, maybe.
Hey, it is. Researchers analyze microscopic paint samples from the canvases using two specific techniques. They use portable X-ray fluorescence and high-performance liquid chromatography. Or HPLC for short.
Okay, so for those of us who haven't been in a chemistry lab recently, how exactly does HPLC work?
Okay, think of HPLC like taking a blended fruit smoothie.
Okay, a smoothie.
And running it through a machine that separates it back out into the exact strawberries, bananas, and blueberries that went into it.
Wait, it unblends it?
Basically, yeah. It separates complex mixtures so you can identify the individual molecular component.
Oh, wow.
And the X-ray fluorescence maps the elemental metals on the canvas. So when they ran these tests, the data revealed that Van Gogh had used what are known as fugitive pigments.
Fugitive, meaning they like run away, they escape.
In a chemical sense, yes. Specifically, he used Red Lake pigments called geranium lake and cochineal.
Cochineal, wait, isn't that?
Made from crushed insects. Yes, it is an organic pigment.
Gross, but fascinating.
Very. But because these are organic compounds, they're tragically sensitive to light.
Ah, I see where this is going.
Yeah, when you expose them to decades of ambient ultraviolet light, the UV rays literally act like a microscopic hammer. They smash the fragile molecular bonds of these organic dyes until they simply stop reflecting red light.
Oh my God. So if purple or lilac, like the walls is just a mixture of red and blue, and the UV light completely destroys the red molecules, you're only left with the blue.
That is exactly the mechanism. The pale lilac walls chemically decayed into light blue.
And floor.
The red tiles of the floor, which were mixed with those same fugitive lakes to create a warm tone, they lost their warmth entirely and turned into the disjunctive muddy tones we see today.
Wait, so when millions of people look at this painting today and they feel this sense of melancholy blue, they're essentially connecting with a chemical defect, not the artist's soul.
It is a sobering realization, isn't it? The delicate chemical balance he relied on simply evaporated into thin air.
But the researchers didn't just theorize this, right? They found actual physical proof.
Undeniable proof. Back in 1931, a restorer named J.C. Trass was tasked with relining the Amsterdam canvas to stabilize it.
Okay.
And during that process, he folded a tiny strip along the bottom edge of the floor over the wooden stretcher, and he covered it with tape.
So it was completely blocked from the museum light.
Yes, because that tiny strip was trapped in total darkness for nearly a century, protected from that microscopic UV hammer, it still retains its original vibrant peachy pink color today.
That is incredible. It acts as a perfect time capsule hiding right there on the edge of the canvas.
Exactly. And using the HPLC on that area, they found chemical signatures of bromine in the faded areas, which is the calling card of degraded geranium lake.
Okay, I have to push back on this then.
Go for it.
If the chemistry has entirely shifted the colors, and in doing so, destroyed the careful complementary balance Van Gogh specifically engineered,
yeah.
Are we even looking at a Van Gogh masterpiece anymore?
That's a huge philosophical issue.
Right. Or are we just looking at an accidental collaboration between Vincent and the ravages of time?
This raises an important question, and it actually sits at the absolute center of modern art conservation.
How so?
Well, how should we treat historical art? When a canvas chemically mutates this drastically, do we accept the decay as a valid part of the object's journey through time?
Like letting it age naturally.
Right. Or do we owe it to the artist to use digital projection or modern LED lighting to visually correct the colors back to their original state?
Oh, projecting colored light onto it to fix it.
Exactly. Because right now, when you look at those blue walls, you're observing history, but you are absolutely not seeing Van Gogh's intention.
It fundamentally changes how you view the work.
It really does.
But the light that destroyed his colors wasn't the only thing trying to erase this painting. The environment itself took a shot.
Nature was really out to get this canvas.
Seriously. Which brings us to the historical mystery of why there are three different versions of this exact same bedroom.
It all stems from a disaster in Arles. In December of 1888, Van Gogh suffered a severe mental breakdown. This is the infamous incident where he mutilated his ear.
Right, the ear incident.
Yeah, and he was hospitalized. While he was away recovering, the River Rhone flooded.
And the floodwaters reached the Yellow House.
They did. The original bedroom painting was sitting right there in his studio.
Yeah.
And it was subjected to terrible, terrible dampness.
Oh, no.
And if you think about how a 19th century painting is constructed, it isn't just paint on fabric. There's a layer of animal hide glue, or sizing, applied to the canvas to prep it.
Okay, kind of like a primer.
Exactly. And when that hide glue is exposed to severe humidity and flood dampness, it swells up and basically turns to mush.
Meaning the foundation holding the paint to the canvas literally dissolves.
Exactly. The paint and the ground layer started horribly flaking off the canvas. When Van Gogh finally returned and saw the damage, he was desperate to save the image.
I can't even imagine his panic.
Right. It was in such terrible shape that he took old newspapers and used them as a makeshift adhesive.
Wait, he just slapped newspaper on it.
He stuck them directly onto the surface of the painting just to hold the flaking paint in place.
You have this priceless, delicate masterpiece, and it is being held together by wet, sticky newspaper. That is insane.
And the Cornell study proves it. Under magnification, they actually found microscopic traces of transferred newsprint still embedded in the Amsterdam canvas today.
The forensic evidence is just so cool.
So after this, Vincent sent the severely damaged newspaper-covered painting to his brother, Theo, in Paris.
Theo was his art dealer, right?
Yes. Theo suggested that the canvas needed to be professionally relined to save it, but Vincent made a crucial decision here.
What did he do?
Before handing it over to a restorer, he demanded it back so he could make copies and preserve his original composition.
Which takes us to September 1889. He's now a patient living in the Saint-Remy Asylum, and he sits down to paint his bedroom again.
He paints it twice, actually. Yeah. First, he makes what he calls a repetition, a meticulously scaled copy, the exact same size as the damaged original.
And that is the version that currently hangs in Chicago.
Correct. Then he makes a smaller reduction copy to send as a gift to his mother and sister back in Holland. That smaller version is the one you can see today at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris.
And the forensics from the Cornell study prove definitively that these are three distinct standalone creations, not just like quick tracing paper knockoffs.
Oh, the technical forensics on this are incredible. Yeah. The researchers used X-radiographs to generate automated weave maps of the canvases.
Okay, let's clarify that for a second. Weave mapping is essentially like looking for a fingerprint, right?
Pretty much.
Because 19th century linen was hand loomed, the grid of the threads is uneven and completely unique to a specific roll of fabric.
That is exactly it. You map the density and the angles of the threads. And the computer analysis proved that none of these three canvases were cut from the same roll of cloth.
So they were definitely done at different times.
Yes, they were painted at distinctly different times using completely different supplies. Furthermore, the way he sketched the room changed.
How so?
In the Amsterdam original, he used painted lines of red lake for the underdrawing. But when you look at the X-rays of the Chicago copy, he used a dry, easily dispersed material, like charcoal, to map out the room before painting.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. The details inside the room actually change depending on which version you are looking at.
Oh, the portraits.
Yes. If you look at the wall to the right of the bed, there are two miniature portraits hanging up. In the first version, the one damaged by the flood, they are portraits of his friends, Eugene Bach and Paul Eugene Millet.
Right.
But when he paints the smaller copy for his family a year later in the asylum, the face in the portrait changes. It becomes a self-portrait of Van Gogh himself without a beard.
It is such a subtle shift, but the psychological weight of it is immense. You know?
It really is.
He is sitting in a room in an asylum, painting a memory of a space he knows he can never, ever return to. and he deliberately places his own face inside that memory.
That detail alone makes me question everything we are taught about him.
How do you mean?
Well, there is this huge cultural trope of Van Gogh as this wild, manic genius who just slashed thick emotion onto the canvas in a frenzy.
Yeah.
But doesn't the fact that he sat down in an asylum more than a year later to meticulously trace, analyze, and recreate his own damaged painting completely shatter that mad artist myth?
It totally dismantles it.
Mm-hmm.
When you analyze the brushwork in the Chicago and Paris copies, it is highly structured.
It's not chaotic at all.
Not at all. The Cornell researchers note a much more deliberate, hatched application of paint compared to the improvisational roughness of his initial work.
Wow.
He wasn't out of control. He was acting as a master technician, diagnosing the flaws in his own past work and methodically recreating it to preserve a specific emotional intent.
He was desperately trying to preserve a feeling of rest that he had lost.
Beautifully put.
But the journey of this room doesn't stop with Van Gogh in the 19th century, because while Vincent made his copies to preserve deep personal emotion, a century later, another legendary artist copied the room for the exact opposite reason.
Yes, we have to talk about the pop art evolution of this image.
In 1992, the iconic pop artist Roy Lichtenstein created a painting called Bedroom at Arles, and the wildest part of this is his source material.
It's so funny.
He didn't travel to Amsterdam to study the original. He didn't even use a high-quality photograph. He based his massive artwork on a cheap commercial calendar reproduction of the Chicago version.
Which is just a brilliant meta-commentary on how society consumes famous art.
And the physical scale of Lichtenstein's version is absurd. Van Gogh painted on standard commercial canvases. They were about 72 by 90 centimeters, small enough to literally carry under your arm.
Very intimate.
Right. But Lichtenstein's painting is over 3 meters high and 4 meters wide. It dominates an entire wall.
And in doing so, he fundamentally strips the original atmosphere right out of the room.
He completely removes all the rustic, handmade emotion. Van Gogh's woven rush chairs are replaced by these sleek, modern tubular chairs.
Very 90s.
Yeah. The rumpled, sweaty clothes hanging on the wall become crisp, iron businessman shirts. And that portrait on the wall, the one Van Gogh so painfully changed to a self-portrait, Lichtenstein replaces the face entirely with his signature comic book-style Bende dots.
Lichtenstein actually joked about his process. He said, and I quote, "I've cleaned his room up a little bit for him. Mine is a rather large painting, and his is rather small. His is much better, but mine is much bigger."
That is so arrogant, but it is such a perfect encapsulation of pop art.
It really is.
It is like taking a deeply personal, heartbreaking acoustic indie song that was recorded in a tiny bedroom and remixing it into a massive, ironic, sterile stadium techno anthem.
That's a great analogy.
Thanks. It's the exact same melody, but the soul has been entirely swapped out.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Lichtenstein's piece highlights the vast, bizarre distance between an original work of art and its endless cultural reproductions.
The commercialization of it all.
It's exactly. By the 1990s, Van Gogh's bedroom wasn't a real place to the public anymore. It was a postcard in a gift shop. It was a coffee mug. It was a calendar page.
It lost its humanity.
Lichtenstein forces us to ponder how mass media flattens emotional history. The absolute restfulness Van Gogh bled for has been replaced by bright industrial process colors.
It is tragic, but it is also incredible to see how a single idea manages to survive by mutating like that.
Absolutely.
So let's bring all of this together. We started with a crooked trapezoidal room in a yellow house in Arles, a physical house that, by the way, doesn't even exist anymore.
Right. It was completely obliterated in a 1944 bombing raid during World War II.
The physical architecture is entirely gone.
Just dust.
But the idea of that space survived. It survived being soaked in river flood waters and patched up with sticky newspaper.
It survived the chemical decay of fugitive red pigments fading into blue.
It survived being meticulously copied in an asylum, and it survived being blown up into a giant, ironic pop art cartoon.
It is a space that stubbornly refuses to disappear.
It really is. So what does this all mean? For you listening right now, I think it's a powerful reminder that the things we create are never truly finished.
They take on a life of their own.
Exactly. We put something out into the world and we assume it's static, but it isn't. It continues to evolve, it decays chemically, it gets misunderstood, and it gets radically reinterpreted by the world long after we are gone. Art is not a fossil. It is alive.
And that leads to a final thought I want to leave you with, looking toward the future.
Ooh, lay it on us.
If Van Gogh's room has survived physical destruction, chemical fading, and pop culture parody, What is its next evolution?
That is the ultimate question. Where does it go from here?
With the rapid rise of virtual reality and spatial computing, the next definitive version of this bedroom might not be on a canvas or a calendar at all.
Oh, wow. Like a digital space.
Exactly. Museums are already experimenting with 3D spatial reconstructions. The primary way the next generation experiences the bedroom in Arles might be as a fully immersive digital environment that you can actually walk into and inhabit.
That completely changes the relationship between the viewer and the art.
We are moving from simply looking at Van Gogh's engineered restfulness through a frame to literally stepping inside of it.
That's wild.
Imagine putting on a headset, closing the digital door behind you, and sitting down on that chrome yellow bed. The painting stops being an object you observe and becomes a room you occupy.
We started today talking about how museums put art behind thick glass, making it feel untouchable. But it turns out the painting has always been reaching out, changing, bleeding, and growing into our world.
Never stopped evolving.
And maybe soon you'll be able to step right through the frame and finally get some rest. Thanks for taking the plunge with us. We'll see you on the next deep dive.